Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to the most important, fastest growing, and now largest segment of society. To those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious institutions, political parties, militaries, and media outlets are corrupt, that they've become counterproductive, that they're part of the problem, not the solution, and that the problems that ail them cannot be resolved. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in this discussion, toll free, anytime, over the next 2 to 3 hours, is 877-300-7645. Yesterday, there was another Islamic attack in France. Another Muslim, screaming Allahu Akbar, running his vehicle into a group of pedestrians. It's the third Islamic terrorist attack in France in as many days. And then we're still reeling from the assassination murder by Ibrahim, a Muslim who killed the two New York cops. He cited Quran 860, a picture of the Quran focused on 860 on his website. Now, the police, politicians, have taken the website down. You see, America is no longer a place of freedom. America is no longer a place where the free press prevails. America is no longer a place where information flows freely. Everything is controlled in America. And it is like so many other instances where access to information would yield a very different conclusion than that being promoted by the media or by politicians is removed from sight. What we did yesterday in the second hour was recite the first half of the eighth surah of the Quran. We're going to conclude the eighth surah of the Quran today. It's important that you understand just how repulsive the Quran is, how vicious it is, how disgusting the Quran's God actually is. It's important that you realize that the Quran isn't a book that is similar to anything you've ever read. If you haven't been exposed to the Quran and you have preconceived notions, I can assure you they are wrong. It is a repulsive book. It's the worst book ever written by any rational criterion. Now, in the case of the Eighth Surah, it begins with wanton, perverted behavior. Muhammad, desperate to do several things. One is he's broke and he's desperate for money. And he has no idea how to earn a day's wage. He's wholly incompetent as it comes to gainful employment. Doesn't know how to farm. He doesn't know how to shepherd. He doesn't know how to make anything. He knows nothing about business. And so Muhammad and his companions are nothing but foul-mouthed thugs. And they decide that they're going to make money the way the mafia does. Armed robbery, intimidation, kidnap, distortion. They are going to exploit the business community. They're going to attack and terrorize those who actually work for a living and are productive. And so Muhammad, claiming to be a prophet, claiming to be God's lone spokesman, decides that he is going to accomplish the other thing he wants, which is to demean his tribe, his neighbors. Because when Muhammad came up with this foolish rant that he was the messenger of God and then began to plagiarize the poetry of the pagan Hanafs in Yemen, and then began to bastardize the Babylonian Talmud as it was recited to him by rabbis, and twisting it and plagiarizing it and bastardizing it and intermixing it with situational scriptures, justifications for egregious behavior on behalf of Muhammad. Those who knew him best mocked him. They said, come on, you're a moron. Go away. And so since it was true that he was a moron, since it was everything that the Meccans said about him was accurate, Muhammad wanted to punish them for not accepting his lie. And so the terrorist attack at Badr, which is really the dawn of the Islamic era, the foundation of what it means to be a Muslim, was a ruthless attack. And the 8th surah is entirely about what happened at Badr and the justifications for terrorism, for armed robbery, for mass murder, for mutilation, for gloating, for deception, for the religion of Islam, really. It is justification for all of those things set into the context of one of the most immoral, criminal, and perverted acts ever attributed to God. And so when Muhammad came up with this idea that he would raid the civilian caravan, terrorizing the civilians, most of the people in Mecca, the converts to Islam, his new religion, knew what he was doing was wrong. They knew that armed robbery was wrong. They knew that mass murder was wrong. They knew that terrorism was wrong. They knew that kidnapping was wrong. They knew that mutilating your neighbors was wrong. Most people know that kind of behavior is evil. But that's what Muhammad wanted to do. And since he had not yet corrupted the religious community to the point that they had no conscience, that they were incapable of being moral, the 8th surah was revealed for the express purpose of telling those who still had a conscience, who were still capable of some shred of morality, that in Islam there would be no morality, that in Islam there would only be terror, there would be murder, there would be threats, there would be robbery. Stealing now was lawful and good. Murder was considered righteous. Thievery was part of the new religion, its means of financing itself. So it's in the context of trying to justify the unjustifiable, a criminal act, that Muhammad comes up with the 8th surah of the Quran. We'll pick it up at Quran 8:39. There are a few statements in religious material as inappropriate and as revealing as this one. So fight them until there is no more disbelief. Fight them until there are no more non-Muslims. And everyone, without exception, submits to the religion of Allah alone. But if they cease, Allah is the seer of what they do. This is an open-ended commandment in the Quran for Muslims to fight until Islam is the only religion, until everyone on earth submits to the demonic deity of Allah. Until you surrender to the most depraved, the most disgusting, the most deadly, the most destructive, the most deceitful religion ever conceived by man, Muslims will continue to fight. And what's interesting here is not only is this an open-ended commandment for all Muslims to fight for all time and in all places, in this particular case, has been the history of Islam, even if every non-Muslim in the world was killed by good fundamentalist Muslims, by jihadists, Muslims would continue to fight. There would still be no peace. If the entire world submitted, which is Islam, and surrendered Islam to the wannabe God called Allah, Muslims would continue to fight and kill. There would still be no peace. They would fight among themselves as they are in Syria, as they are in Iraq, as they are in Yemen, as they are in Egypt, as they are in the Sudan. They would continue to kill. So fight them until there is no more disbelief. There are no more non-Muslims. And all submit to the religion of Allah alone. Fight them. Forever. For all time. There is no such statement in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. The encouragement from Yahweh to fight is limited to less than a dozen towns and villages, and a place representing 0.1% of the world, specific to very specific towns, none of which exist anymore, in one very small sliver of the world, as opposed to the whole world, and it's for one tiny sliver of time. And for one specific reason. Yahweh wasn't interested in people submitting to or surrendering to a religion. In fact, he wants the opposite. He had promised the promised land, Yisrael, to Abraham's descendants. And he honors his promises. But he was not willing to allow them to move into it and give it to them until such time as the corruption of those inhabiting the land was so egregious that it could not be resolved, to the point that there was no hope for them. And just as a loving father would rid his home of poisonous and venomous infected animals before allowing his family to move in, that was the instruction in the prophets. The order is clear in Quran 8:39. Fight until the whole world is in submission to Allah's Islam. It is sobering, isn't it? Then the next verse reads, if people are obstinate and refuse to surrender, so if people are unwilling to submit, to surrender to Allah, who is modeled after Satan, know that Allah is your border. And know that 1/5 of all booty that you take belongs to Allah. And, of course, to Allah's pal, the messenger. And for the near relatives, orphans, and the needy wayfarer, by the way, Muslims never gave money to orphans. They never gave money to a needy wayfarer. They sure as hell gave it to Muhammad, though. And Allah, you know, Allah never seemed to do anything, including take his 20% of the booty off the top. So this is, you know, if people are obstinate, if they're unwilling to surrender, submit to the religion of Islam, then understand that Allah is the supporter of the jihadists, and you are now authorized and empowered to engage in armed robbery. But there's rules. Yep, the rules. What do you think the rules are? That you can't be indiscriminately murderous? No. That you can't deceive your victim? No. That you can't rob from poor people? No. That let me tell you, there's only one rule. And the rule was stated here. That whatever you steal, no matter how you steal it, no matter who you rob, you must give 20% of what you steal to the big Muhammad. Yes, Muhammad. That's right. Muhammad was the head of the international crime syndicate known as Islam. Believe in Allah and in what we have sent down to our servant on the day of victory over the infidels when the two armies clashed, and Allah has the power to do all things. You know, when your God lies, then you have a problem. First of all, there were no armies. There wasn't an army on either side. On the victim side, the Meccan caravan, you've got some businessmen. I mean, their skill set was herding camels between oases so that they could traverse very barren, dry territory. And they would purchase goods made by typically very poor craftsmen in Arabia and attempt to trade those goods, or could be skins or pelts, you know. It's not food because they don't grow anything, with civilizations like Egypt in most cases. And then they would bring back foodstuffs from Egypt. They would bring back material that could be used in the impoverished communities of Arabia. That was their only skill set, is to be able to shepherd their camels through this very difficult terrain. They had no army. They never had to have an army. There was no case of people being this sadistic, this immoral, before Muhammad created Islam. So there most certainly wasn't an army on the side of the Meccans. In fact, the Meccans never had an army. In fact, of Muhammad's 75 terrorist raids in the first 10 years of the Islamic era, he never confronted an army a single time. Not even a division of an army, not even a single soldier. Not one soldier, much less an army. And Muhammad never had an army. He had a militia. He had what he called mujahideen. He had jihadists. But they were not an army in any sense of the word. They were just civilians enraged by and poisoned by Muhammad's religion, who were armed with whatever weapons they could steal and find. And they universally attacked civilians. This notion that two armies met and that Allah prevailed is an absolute and complete fabrication of the history of the event. You know, when your alleged God has to lie and exaggerate to make it sound like he is relevant, like he has some influence, you've got a serious problem. Why would you believe a God that lies? The detailed hadith, oral reports from Muhammad and his companions about what happened at Badr are prolific. Every aspect of what happened there and who engaged against whom, all of the details are overwhelmingly and convincingly presented. There was absolutely no involvement of any wannabe God. And, I mean, this was just a skirmish between an armed group and essentially an unarmed group of civilians, one laying in wait for the other. It was a surprise attack, which makes it a terrorist attack, really, on some businessmen. And to pretend that armies clashed. And if you're a Muslim and you're reading this stuff, what goes through your mind? You know, there are Muslims that pretend to be really pious and peaceful and tranquil and talk about how their religion, it doesn't promote fighting and terror and jihad is a spiritual struggle. When you read this crap out of the Quran, what do you think? Do you read it? Can you process it? Or are you like Christians and you come to 2 Corinthians where Paul admits that he's insane and that he's demon-possessed and that his ego is out of control? You just read past it and pretend it's not there. Continuing, this is now 8:42. You were on the hither side of the valley, and they were on yonder bank. The caravan was on lower ground. See, it's a caravan, not an army, not a battalion, not a corps of soldiers. A caravan was on the lower ground. Even if you had made a mutual appointment to meet, Oh, can I set an appointment? I want to rob you. And by the way, I would also appreciate if you'd let me kill some of you. And those that we kill, I'd like to set a time that would be convenient to allow me to mutilate your bodies. And then, if you know it's not too much of an inconvenience, let's establish a subsequent time where I can then gloat over your mutilated bodies. I appreciate it very much. And let's not forget to set an appointment for some kidnappings. Yeah, if you had set a mutual time appointment to meet, you would certainly have declined to fight and failed to achieve your goal because Allah needed to accomplish a different matter. Those who were destroyed had to perish as a clear demonstration, and those who lived survived as a positive proof. Allah is He who hears and knows. Oh, yeah. You're going to remind the people that Allah, which is the black stone of the Kaaba, one of 360 stones in the Kaaba, is a stone that, you know, actually can hear. It's a knowing stone. This Allah stone is superior to your average weather rock. You know, the weather rock can tell you if it's raining when it's wet. It can tell you when it's snowing, when it turns white. It can tell you that the sun's out when it's hot. Well, Allah knows and hears. And so here's a depiction that, you know, you just wanted to rob the caravan, but Allah, yeah, He wanted some killing. Yeah, Allah wanted to kill them. Well, you just wanted to rob them. Oh, believers, this would be, oh, Muslims, when you meet an army, be firm and think of Allah's name often, that you may prosper. Obey Allah and His messenger, and do not dispute, lest you lose courage and your power departs. Persevere. Again, there was no army. Muslims today very seldom attack armies. Almost all Islamic belligerence is acts of terrorism against civilians. This was an act of terrorism against civilians. It also affirms that Allah, as in Allahu Akbar, the third mutilation of innocent victims in France in 3 days in a row was by another person's shouting Allahu Akbar, which the media incorrectly rendered it God is great. It's not God is great. It's Allah. Allah is the Islamic God's name. Of course, we have to also mention here that how would one obey Muhammad unless one has Muhammad's orders? And since the Quran purports to be only Allah's orders, why would you even say, and the messenger, unless there was a source of orders from the messenger, or unless the messenger and his wannabe God Allah were actually one and the same? Either way, you either have to have Muhammad's orders, or you need to know that there is no distinction between Allah and Muhammad. Both are bad for Islam because it's an obvious fraud when Allah and Muhammad are one, and therefore you would have Muhammad's orders in the Quran because he and Allah are the same. Or you have to turn to the Hadith, and the Hadith prove overwhelmingly that Muhammad was the most perverted man who ever lived. Either way, it's really bad. The next verse reads, "Do not be as those who come from their homes full of their own importance, trying to turn men away from fighting in Allah's cause. Allah is encircling them. Satan made their act seem alluring to them and said, 'No one can conquer you this day while I am near you.' But when the two armies came into sight of each other, he turned on his heels and said, 'Lo, I am not with you. If I see what you cannot, verily I fear Allah, for Allah is severe in punishment.'" Once again, Muhammad told his jihadists very limited information. He knew that if he told them, "Hey, we're going to go rob a civilian caravan of a neighboring community, my own tribe, we're going to steal their property, and we're going to kill them, and then we're going to kidnap for ransom others," he would have had a very difficult time at this stage of Islam. This is the first terrorist raid in the history of Islam. He's going to have a very difficult time getting most people to go along because they still have a conscience. But he then, according to this verse, once they are in a position where now he can reveal his entire plot. It's kind of like 9/11. They didn't tell the 9/11 jihadists what was going to occur until that morning. They didn't know what their mission was. You know, people that have a conscience can say, "Well, no, this is really a bad idea," if they're allowed to think about it. Muhammad didn't allow anyone to think about it. And so this is just saying, you know, as a Muslim, if you are unwilling to engage in jihad and fight in Allah's cause, if you're unwilling to kill in Allah's cause, to rob, to terrorize in Allah's cause, then you cease to be a Muslim, and Allah's going to punish you. So if you're a peaceful Muslim, this is one of 100 passages that tell you that your God hates you. Yes, the wannabe God known as Allah hates hypocrites, Muslims who pretend that Islam is a peaceful religion. 8:47 then reads, "Be not among those..." I just shared that with you. That was 8:47 that affirms that Allah is severe in punishment. 8:49. "When the hypocrites," which would be bad Muslims, "and those in their hearts is the disease, said, 'The religion has deceived and misled them.'" Those who knew Muhammad best, those who still had a conscience, those who could discern right from wrong, realized that terror, robbery, thievery, mass murder, sadistic behavior, deceit, were wrong. Kidnapping was wrong. And so what the Quran is saying here is that if you know those things are wrong and you say those things are wrong, that Muhammad and his religion have deceived and misled those who perpetrate these kind of criminal acts, these kinds of immoral behaviors. If you say that, which is exactly what any moral, informed, and rational person is going to say, then according to Allah, in your heart is a disease. You're a hypocrite. If you're a Muslim, for example, and you condemn Islamic terrorism, according to the Quran, you're a diseased individual and a hypocrite. If you're a Muslim and say that terrorism is incompatible with Islam, that suicide bombings are incompatible with Islam, that the rape and kidnap of little girls is incompatible with Islam, then according to the Quran, you, dear Islamic scholar, Islamic spokesperson, Islamic imam, are a fraud. Your God thinks you're diseased. You are a hypocrite. Not my definition, the Quran's definition. It would also be mine because it's also true. Quran 8:50. If you could have seen the infidels when the angels drew away their souls, striking their faces and smiting their backs, the angels said, "Taste the penalty of the burning fire." So Allah is claiming that while the Muslims are murdering non-Muslims, that it's really the angels that are there drawing away the souls of their victims. And that it isn't enough that these innocent people would be victimized by this ruthless religion of Islam. No, Allah's angels bring down blazing fire. Now, I don't know what blazing fire does to a soul, but nonetheless, they say, taste the penalty of the blazing fire. They strike their faces. I don't know how you strike a face when you're dealing with a soul, but nonetheless, that's what Allah says. And they smite them on their backs. Once again, this is so stupid that it's laughable if it wasn't so perverse. It is appropriate for Allah, by the way, to say that his angels, and they really aren't angels, this is just a part of the stupidity of Islam. They are malak messengers. But Allah, as Satan, has a considerable host of fallen malak, which we know as demons. And they would enjoy tormenting souls. Now, of course, they can't draw away the souls and then strike their faces and smite their backs, nor draw away the souls and say, taste the penalty of a blazing fire. None of that works. That's just stupid. But nonetheless, it is true that Allah's angels are demons, and therefore this is the role they will actually play. But part of this is, this part of the story is true to the point that it's at least not insane. 852. They, this would be the Meccan civilians, brought this on themselves. You know, for what? Because they were productively engaged in business, as opposed to the Muslims who were only engaged in thievery. Brought them on themselves. Their case is like that of Pharaoh. And of those before them. I mean, Mecca was a mud hut of a town. They didn't grow anything. They didn't produce anything. There wasn't a single stone structure in the community. Even the Kaaba was a pile of loose stones. So no monument, no nothing, no writing system. To compare the Meccans and this mud hut back wadi town to the Egyptians and Pharaoh, it's like, okay, so Muhammad heard from Jews that God had a battle with Pharaoh's armies. That story happens to be true. And God didn't need the children of Israel to be armed, and they weren't armed. To fight, they didn't fight. And God took on a real army and destroyed them. Wiped them away. Now, that's a real story. And so Allah is trying to say, well, you know, I'm that same God. I'm going to steal Yahweh's credibility here. Since I can't do anything, I'm going to take one of his acts. So this is, he's pretending like the Meccans are like the Egyptians, which is laughable in the extreme. Pharaoh, and of those before them, and they denied and rejected the revelations of Allah. I can assure you that since Allah was not invented until the late 6th century CE, at a time that Egypt no longer existed, Egypt as an independent country ceased to exist after Alexander the Great conquered them. But 3rd century BCE, that was it for Egypt. So it, essentially 1,000 years that there were no pharaohs and that Egypt ceased to exist as an independent country before Allah was even invented, to show you how perverse this is historically. And there was the first revelation of Allah was spoken in the 7th century, early 7th century, fully 1,000 years after the last pharaoh. That's how historically inaccurate the Quran is. And Allah destroyed them, punishing them for their crimes, and Allah is strict, severe in punishment. Well, the Egyptians were not destroyed. They ceased to be an independent country, but they were never destroyed. There is no case where Egypt was destroyed. Not by God, not by a foreign power. And there was almost no fighting with Alexander the Great. Egypt had lost its mojo long before Alexander the Great arrived. There was really no conquest, even by the Romans. Now, Egypt was never destroyed by a deity, never destroyed by a invading army. So, once again, Allah has lied. He can't even get history right. Not only aren't any accurate predictions, prophecies in the Quran's depiction of history is error. Why would you trust a God? Why would you trust a book that even the history is wrong? And this is a known nation, but the history is well preserved.